Shrinkwrap Radio number 633, the quest to create personally transformative apps with entrepreneur Steve Curtis.
It's Shrinkwrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today's episode is sponsored by Blinkist.com, providing the key takeaways from the world's best nonfiction books. My guest today is Steve Curtis, founder and CEO of EvolveBiologics.com, a company that is developing an upcoming smartphone app for meditation and internal states training. We'll be discussing that product along with the future of apps that potentially will promote deep personal transformation. For more about Steve Curtis, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Steve Curtis, welcome to Shrinkwrap Radio.
Hi, Dave. Glad to be here.
Well, I am so excited to have you. This has been planned months in advance. And so you've been kind of a man of mystery to me up to this point, and I'm sure vice versa. You've been traveling, working in different parts of the world, and you're involved with a number of companies. And so I feel really blessed to have this time to spend with you and to get to know you a bit. And you are involved in a number of companies, and the one that I know you sort of through is called Evolve Biologics. And so, of course, I'm interested in finding out about that and sharing that with my listeners and getting your vision of the future for that. But I'm really interested in your life story. One of your assistants sent me about two short paragraphs. And they were so intriguing. I thought, well, that's where the heart of this is. So I hope you'll be okay with that program.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay. So where did you grow up?
So I grew up in British Columbia, Canada, a little suburb of Vancouver called Burnaby. And then I lived in Vancouver most of my life. It's not necessarily the best place to be in the winter, unless you like to snowboard and ski a lot, which I used to. But in the summer, for me, it's one of the most beautiful places on earth.
Yeah, I used to. I was into skiing for a number of years, and it was always my ambition to ski at Whistler, but I never made it there. And now as I've gotten older, my balance is shot, so I'm afraid my skiing days are over. But still, it's one of the highest experiences, I think, of my life, along with some other ones. But I used to have this fantasy about if people from outer space were to come here and they happened to come to a ski resort first, that they would go back home and talk about the planet of the mountain riders.
I love that.
Yeah, isn't that a nice image?
Yeah, so, there is something just wonderful about flying through powder for sure on the snowboard.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and learning to. It took me a while to learn that a big part of the secret of skiing is flowing with gravity, giving in to gravity. And as a beginner, you're sort of holding against it and trying to cling to the mountain. But as you become more comfortable, you learn that you can't get started and do all those nice turns if you're not moving. So you've got to risk pointing your skis downhill and trust that you're going to be able to turn. So to me, that's a really a metaphor in a lot of ways, a good metaphor for life.
Yeah.
And so speaking of life and growing up, part of what you're those couple of paragraphs of bio that I got indicated was that you did not grow up wealthy, but rather, and you did not grow up the scion of a big businessman, from what I can see, but were the son of a low-income single mom. Tell us a little bit about that set of circumstances that you were born into.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up with my mom exclusively for the first 7 years of my life, and Just such a wonderful woman. It taught me so many things. And I was an only child, so I got a lot of attention. Yeah. I think that sometimes makes it difficult for people in my life, but I'm working on it.
Okay.
I was a high IQ ADHD kid who just loved to figure things out. I had an immense curiosity. And in the early part of my life, that was really wonderful. As I got into school, it became a little bit more challenging. So I think Mom was pretty critical about how she raised me. I thought she was just amazing, but I think she took her job very conscientiously. And so I was in lots of different things, Cubs and Boy Scouts and Army cadets and, piano lessons and swim lessons. And she was just very much about teaching and developing me.
Well, it's interesting that you're into so many things now, different companies, different enterprises, and I'm a little bit that way in that my interests go all over the place, but I don't necessarily turn each one of them into a company. So you said that you were ADHD. Was that an official thing or just describing yourself as a really active kid?
Yeah, it did become official. I think that's where it kind of interestingly enters the debate, right, about education. I have a lot of passion for education and helping youth that kind of fall in the category of at risk, either because of learning disabilities or learning abilities. And for whatever reason, I had a really hard time sitting in class. I was pretty good at math, and I refused to show my work in math. I would just kind of answer the questions, and the teachers usually didn't like that because if I didn't show my work, then other students did.
Yeah.
Tried to copy. And so I spent a lot of time in the hallway and actually got expelled from school in grade 6. I don't know whether that's something to brag about, but.
Well, it could be. I mean, if we follow in line the way that we're taught to do everything as prescribed, we'll lead a pretty predictable life. And it sounds like early on you were not into leading such a predictable life. And so one of the things I read was that you had your first business at age 19. What was it? And tell us about that and how that came to be.
Yeah, sure. So when I left school in grade 6, it was a pretty challenging experience for me at the time. And it took a lot of years to figure out really how challenging that was. I think most people have trauma of some kind in their life. And for me, I didn't go to school in grade 6 or 7. I felt a lot of loneliness. I was kind of the bad kid that got expelled. So parents didn't want me to have, be friends with their kids. And
yeah.
I watched a lot of television, Discovery Channel, Learning Channel. When there used to be things to learn on the Learning Channel, now it seems less educational. But I played Jeopardy. And I read a lot of books. And then I went back to school in grade 8, and I kind of kept up to speed, did some honors classes and got straight A's, but then got a little bored with that and was dropped out of school again in grade 9. And Mom was a little bit unhappy at this point. She said, if you're going to stand under this roof, you need to get a job. So there aren't many jobs that high school dropouts can get, and kind of looked through the newspaper about the qualifications and saw that sales was probably the only thing I could do. So I got a job selling dishes at carnivals, selling like $5,000 China sets, and
wow,
and that turned into car sales and door to door sales and all this stuff. And at 17, I got involved in the internet. It was the .com boom in 2001, and I realized that over the phone, nobody really cared how old I was or how much experience I had, or even what my degrees were, or whether I went to school. It was before LinkedIn, so it was all about could you navigate the uncertainty of the internet. And I started becoming quite successful. I was making $150,000 a year at 17 doing online advertising, and and then the CEO thought I was making a little bit too much, so cut my commission, and I decided to do it on my own. And So I started a company in search engine optimization, and my strategy was I knew how to make websites position under particular keywords in the search engine. So taking the sales background and the technical background, I started a company and to help companies position. And I thought, well, let's start at the top. So I started calling Fortune 500 CEOs,
Wow.
and it turns out that back then, if you called them on their local extension, which I found in a database, if you called them between sort of 7:30 and 8:30 local time, sometimes they would answer their phone. So I got a few CEOs who introduced me to a few VPs of marketing and director of marketing and internet marketing manager. And even though the .com had really just crashed right after I started the business, I got a few internet marketing managers that were quite excited that I knew their CEO and did a few contracts and opened a company. And within a couple of years, we had 20 staff and a few million in revenue.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Did you have a mentor, somebody? I mean, you jump both feet into the world of business. Did you have a mentor at any point, kind of holding your hand, encouraging you?
You know, back then, I didn't really have anybody that I knew. As you mentioned, I didn't have anybody in my family in business, and the whole thing was kind of foreign to my mother. She was a receptionist with the Canadian government, and so it was all very abstract. But I really did like to read, and I've been a lifelong fan of reading. I'm across 650 books now. I have libraries everywhere. I do a lot of Audible these days, usually a book.
Me too. So, oh, well, yeah. I used to do Audible, but I've switched to, I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's called Libro.fm. And
okay.
it's the small independent bookstores fighting back by coming together and creating their own Audible. And it costs the same amount as Audible, but your credits never expire. And they do on Audible. I got ticked off at them because of that.
Okay.
And, I'll be happy to point you that direction. Check it out.
Yeah. So I guess kind of answering your question, I was a big fan of reading biographies. And I guess I've really come to believe that any challenge or question that exists, there's people that have, for the most part, experienced these kind of things before. As we approach some of these technological uncertainties of our future, there are lots of theories, not necessarily biographies that have navigated them, but I was able to find some pretty good stories, and I took those on and found a way to navigate it. But that being said, there was this sort of interpersonal level that I couldn't really pick up from a book, and I didn't understand the importance of therapy and doing work and healing trauma, and that really started to take a toll on me as a leader, having 20 staff and 35 staff at 24. And just not knowing anything about myself, let alone how to work with people and lead people, it was a fairly challenging situation.
I've often heard that about Silicon Valley types that may be very technically proficient and technically oriented, but haven't quite learned to navigate the interpersonal space. So that's really interesting. And you talk about trauma, and one of the things that was in the bio that I read was that you were diagnosed with cancer at 24. And given 2 years to live, what kind of cancer was that?
It was a peripheral T-cell lymphoma, not otherwise specified. So it was immune system illness. The white blood cells were replicating in my body and uncontrollably. And it was something that usually people got much later in life. At the time, it was really a big surprise for me. But in retrospect, I think it was something that I should have been able to see coming based on how I was living.
Which was how?
unhealed trauma, really. I through that whole journey, I've come to see the world in a very different way. Those childhood experiences created a lot of stress and anxiety, and rather than trying to understand the beliefs I held about the world, I tried to suppress the pain that I had in response. I tried to suppress the symptoms with alcohol. I was an alcoholic in my early 20s. I mean, I would drink at night until I passed out and fell asleep. And sometimes I would drink during the day. I would drink massive amounts of caffeine in the day to try and stay awake. And then when the alcohol didn't work, I would use sleeping pills to fall asleep. Usually,
clone. yeah, bad combination. So on the one hand, there was this tremendous success, but also a tremendous amount of pain and unhappiness.
Yeah. I mean, financially, and it was amazing, and awards, and lots of recognition. But the inner world had a lot of pain, and I'm sure there's at least a few people listening that can identify with that. And we get pretty good at coping and boxing it.
Yeah.
And so for me, I started to have these health symptoms. I had headaches that started to appear, and and stomach aches that turned into IBS symptoms. And then I had these full body stress itches that came on. Just, I'd be sitting, you know, if I was sitting here and then just got really itchy, uncontrollably itchy. And the body saying, hey, stop. Whatever.
Before we get any further into Steve's remarkable story, I want to acknowledge the sponsor for today's episode, Blinkist. Blinkist.com is a website and an app that allows you to absorb the big ideas of a book in about 15 minutes. We're all short on time these days, so the idea that in about 15 minutes you can get all the key ideas from a nonfiction book you're interested in is, well, remarkable. I know you enjoy listening to podcasts. Like podcasts, Blinkist selections can be either read or listened to even when you're waiting at the doctor's office or driving your car or whatever. Now, Blinkist editors comb the bestseller lists for the most intriguing nonfiction reads out there and pull out the most important insights, which they call blinks. They carefully craft a structure of blinks to bring the key ideas to light. The selection of books is quite large, covering a wide range of nonfiction categories, ranging through such topics as mindfulness, leadership, psychology, physics, philosophy, self-help, business, and more. For example, I must admit with some degree of embarrassment that I never read William James' seminal 1902 book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. Well, in about 15 minutes, I was able to absorb a number of the big ideas. For example, I learned that James distinguished between institutional religion and personal religion. And that's a distinction that's perhaps even more relevant today than in James's time. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our Shrink Wrap Radio listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/shrink to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, and it's spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/shrink to start your free 7-day trial. Once more, it's Blinkist.com/shrink. So with that, let's get back to Steve's fascinating and miraculous journey of self-discovery and more. You mentioned psychotherapy. Was psychotherapy part of your journey?
Yeah. It was. So all those symptoms kind of progressed, and then I got this little spot on my chest, and the spot turned into more spots, and I didn't even have a GP at the time, so I went to kind of a walk-in clinic, and they prescribed the usual things, a cream and a lotion, and whether it was topical steroids or Nizoral shampoo and, you know, various things. And I was on the internet kind of looking and saying, those were supposed to resolve it in a few weeks. And it's been like 6 months. So clearly, but up here we have free healthcare, but there are also challenges with that. It's challenging for doctors to really be on top of everything. And I didn't really... didn't feel like I was getting the attention I needed, so I pushed and got a specialist referral, and that's when I ended up in the oncology clinic. Really, they did some biopsies, and I heard I had cancer, and that was one of those moments that you never really forget. It's like a bomb goes off in the room.
Yeah. Wow.
And so kind of leading up to that, there was some therapy that I had started to partake in, just sort of CBT primarily with a really experienced gentleman who had worked with leaders. And I really realized that as I approached these leadership challenges, that a lot of it had to do with how I viewed myself and the relationship that I had with myself. And we hear a lot about self-love. And I came to understand that I absolutely had no idea what that was. Mm-hmm. And so before the cancer journey, I was starting to do some of that work, but afterwards, based on this particular situation I was in, I learned that I needed to do a lot more.
Yeah. So what did you do with that dread information once you understood that, whoa, this is very serious? Drink a lot? What did you do?
You know, I don't remember if I got drunk right after. I don't think that was my response. I think I didn't have much respect for authority per se at that point in my life. And so I went on PubMed, because I had heard about that, and I put in my condition, and the doctor wanted me to start chemo the next Monday, and it was a protocol called CHOP. So I wanted to understand what CHOP was. And I saw that if you took this very aggressive chemo, that pretty much guaranteed to have other cancers 5 or 10 years later. And so I thought, well, this is pretty serious. And I pulled a bunch more papers and read that if there was more than one spot, that it was diagnosed as stage 4, and doing chemo didn't change the overall survival time. And the Kaplan-Meier curves didn't look very good. So I went back to this oncologist and really debated with him. I said, you know, I'd like you to read this paper. And he didn't want to read the paper. And this was really one of the first experiences I had, well, maybe the second experience with medicine, how people can sometimes get entrenched in their position. And I really, I was surprised that as a 24-year-old kid alone in there, that he wouldn't read the paper, that he wouldn't do a little bit more research, that we wouldn't biopsy a couple more of the spots. And that's really inspired me through this journey to realize that there are other people there that might not be as irreverent as me or as feisty to challenge him. I think after a little bit of conversation, used a few profanities and fired my oncologist. And then I was a little bit uncertain, but I had a few friends, and it led to somebody on the board, and the board called the senior doctor that wasn't practicing, who brought me in and biopsied the extra spots, and eventually led me to this position that, hey, we don't make mistakes often, but in this case, it is stage 4, and we don't have a treatment for you, but we're working on treatment, so just hang in there and, you know, hope for the best. So for me, I'm not a hope for the best kind of guy. I'm let's make the best. And so I went to the university and got year one med school textbooks and hired an MD and started pulling papers on my condition and talking to researchers. And I must have read a couple hundred books, and I was doing online med school. I wanted to understand everything about the body, which really came from this understanding that the answers weren't necessarily available, but that it would be a fun journey. And in that journey, I confronted all kinds of interesting questions, like whether I wanted to live. And that was a big turning point for me. I realized that part of the reason that cancer came was that I wasn't taking responsibility for my life, and also that I wasn't happy. I didn't feel peace. I didn't feel love. I didn't feel joy. I felt anxiety and depression all the time. Yeah. And it was one of the natural health practitioners that asked me if I wanted to live. And I responded by getting really angry, which usually says there's something there.
Yeah,
so
right.
Kind of came around to me that was one of the first things I needed to solve, which is what really led me into making some different choices about my life.
Yeah. And I read that in your quest, you consulted not only academics at Stanford and Yale, but also shamans in the Amazon. So tell us a bit about that part.
Yeah.
You were really looking for answers and starting the inner search, it sounds like.
Yeah. So that was, let's see, how long? That was about 13 years ago. And I think that was kind of in the valley on psychedelics. They weren't quite so significant at the time. We had the 60s and 70s, and we have the modern day psychedelic renaissance. But at the time, there wasn't as much information on it. So one of the people I thought to call was Dennis McKenna, and
a well known figure in the psychedelic world. Yeah,
exactly. And I called him and I said, hey, you know, Dennis, I'd met him before. And I said, Dennis, I got this diagnosis. There's no modern medical cure for it. I'm trying to make one, but I don't know how that's going to go. You've traveled around. What do you suggest? He has kind of a funny voice. He said, I'd do 5 grams of magic mushrooms and see what's on the other side.
Wow, that's great.
So I didn't know anywhere to get mushrooms. I mean, alcohol and sleeping pills, I had that covered, but yeah. Mushrooms were a little trickier. So I asked around at work, and remember they didn't think that I wanted those kind of mushrooms. So there's a whole conversation. No, the ones that make you,
Yeah.
But I got some, and in a fairly unsupervised way, just ate 5 grams and had one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. I wrote about it in my book, and it was a lot of anxiety, and I couldn't breathe for hours upon time. I felt like I was dying, and I think people would call that a bad trip, but in retrospect, it was brilliant. It was amazing. It was exactly what I needed. It was hard.
How so? How so?
Well, the realization, when I was driving, that I was actually in Whistler. I did them in Whistler.
Wow. It's not my first association to what people do in Whistler. I know they get high, but.
So on the way up, I was listening to all this intense music. And after this experience on the way back, I was about an hour into my journey and I didn't have any music on the radio. And I was just driving along and I felt kind of peaceful. And I didn't really understand what that was about until later. The dynamic relationship between anxiety and depression all the time, and the terrifying anxiety, I should say, and then peace of sort of working through those things, and I realized that the feelings I had in that psychedelic experience were there all the time. I just had learned to block them. I learned to suppress them, like that iceberg that we study so often, the things we push down.
Yeah.
And I had a new sense of myself. I had a new sense of my body and my mind. And it eventually led to this deep inspiration to think about how we could create feedback mechanisms for people to be able to see the inner world in real time, to be able to see the emotions and feelings and experiences that we're having. Because I had become aware, and these spots on my skin started to be, they were itchy, they were red. At certain times I was experiencing stress in the world. And before that experience with psychedelics, I didn't notice that. But afterwards, I could see the totality of what was happening in my body with much more clarity.
God, what a story in terms of the potential value, and in your case, actual value of psychedelics. You know, there's so much of stigma around psychedelics, and yet there are these kinds of stories. Now, you mentioned going to the Amazon, and today ayahuasca is a very huge phenomenon of people who've gone to the Amazon and been in ceremony with a variety of shaman down there. In fact, one of my former students runs one of the major companies that does that kind of thing. And when he was a master's student under me, he said, and I was teaching a course on consciousness, altered states of consciousness, and he said, David, shamanism, you've got to get into shamanism. You've got to study that. Well, he was from a Hispanic culture, and I wasn't. And man, did that ever turn out? Was he ever seeing into the future? It was mind-blowing, because now reportedly there are ayahuasca circles all over the world, just about, you know, as we're speaking right now, there are probably hundreds or thousands of ayahuasca circles. It's kind of exploding. So I guess I'm asking, was ayahuasca part of your journey, or has it been?
Yeah, it has been, but more recently after the healing journey. Primarily psilocybin. There were a couple other psychedelics, so peyote and interestingly salvia divinorum. Those were all components that were sort of helping to illuminate the inner world. There's a bunch of other things I tried in that journey, but I wouldn't necessarily qualify those as medicine. More just curiosity.
Yeah, I don't know if you've run across the work of Paul Austin. He's a podcaster, among other things. His podcast is called The Third Wave, and I highly recommend it to you. And because evidently there are a lot of Silicon Valley types, you may already know this, who are doing microdosing of various psychedelics to try to increase their sharpness and so on. And that's one phenomenon that he's got his finger on the pulse of. So he talks about the third wave of psychedelics, the first wave being the aboriginal peoples who used it as part of their way of being in the world and communing with the forces of nature. The second wave was part of the second wave in the time of Timothy Leary and so on, and I was in graduate school and there to learn what I could about human experience, and so of course I didn't want to miss that. And now we're in what he calls the third wave, which is very different in some ways and very very inspiring, and in many ways triggered by Michael Pollan's book. Have you checked that book out yet?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, wonderful book.
Yeah, he was just up here recently.
Yeah, it's inspired a lot of people. And so somewhere in there also we should mention you climbed Mount Everest, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that was my irreverence at peak for sure. When I was diagnosed, I'm a big fan of, placebo and nocebo, such interesting things, right? How is it that some people can heal from things naturally and others die from things, even when they have the wrong diagnosis? The literature is full of people that got diagnosed with something they didn't have and became worse and worse and worse. And I'm sure some died and some almost died. And then the doctor comes in last minute and says, oh, no, we got it wrong. And they get better instantaneously.
Wow.
The expectation, right? Or if we look at anti-anxiety drugs and antidepressant, it's not that big of a gap between placebo and the actual molecules, which some people are quite challenged by. And so when I got this, death sentence, what would be the most crazy, powerful way to defy that prognosis? What would be the way that I could calibrate my life to something else? And I thought about when I was younger, I'd watched at home alone, and then those tough years, I watched a PBS special on Everest, and I thought, that'd be cool, but something I could probably never do. And so I thought that'd be a pretty good defiance of the whole thing if I, 5 years after diagnosis, summited Everest and raised $1 million for charity, and when I came down, had no cancer, and then dedicated my life to helping other people do the same thing, particularly around how to let go of illness and choose a meaningful, purpose-filled life. And so rather than focusing on all the bad things that could happen, I wanted to extinguish that conditioned response of illness and that nocebo, so to speak. And I started training for Everest. As I was reading these books, I'd go out and do the mountains, and I put it on my desktop, and it also helped me segregate my friends pretty well. I mean, when you're going through a journey of change, of any kind of change, you usually have to let a few people go. And for me, the people who saw me as sick or dying were people that I chose to let go. So I'd say, yeah, I'm training for Everest. And anybody that gave that sad look like it wasn't going to happen,
yeah,
not my friend anymore.
Wow.
And I just really segregated around that. And as I progressed with the journey, things just kind of unfolded in that way. And about 5 years after diagnosis, I summited Everest from the north side, from Tibet, which was quite a surreal experience. It's kind of the harder side of Everest to summit from. And there are bodies all along the trail, which was just so, emotional in so many ways, to think back about the cancer journey and Everest and the people that had died in the support groups I was in, and what was the state of mind that took me there. And it turned out to be a pretty difficult adventure.
I would think so. I've seen most of the Everest movies, and so I'm a vicarious Everest climber.
Yeah, so it was pretty much like a movie. The storm moved in, we got stuck in the death zone, and I went with four people, and only three came back, and it was pretty intense. But it definitely left me with a different way of looking at the world, about the power of the human mind, and about belief, and about faith.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you said that was in my book. You've written a book, I gather, that is about to come out or hasn't come out yet?
We've been so busy, I haven't focused on publishing the book, but I think we'll be getting that out finally this year.
Yeah, what's the title?
The working title is Curing Terminal. We have a different title we might launch with, but it's sort of one part science, one part psychology. What was the psychology of change? And then one part just story about the various things that happened along the way.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure my listeners will be too. So, yeah, I definitely want to know when that's available. So you started to go into the work that you've done, wanting to, I gather, combine technology and what you know about technology and with consciousness and with physical health. And so you've got this company called Evolve Biologics, biologics spelled with an X rather than a CS, which, so tell us about that. I believe there's a smartphone product that's in development, and tell us what you are comfortable telling us. I don't know whether it's highly secretive or not.
Oh, it's coming along. So after Everest, coming down and being in this position where somehow cancer had left my life through this long journey of yoga and meditation and psychedelic medicine and so many interesting people. I mean, shamanism is more than just taking a plant. It's a journey of an inner world. And as I meditated deeper, there was all kinds of interesting phenomena that happened that, I don't know your meditation experience specifically, but probably for some of your users, meditating 6 to 8 hours a day, the world changes in a lot of different ways. And so these experiences to kind of navigate through something that medicine said wasn't possible, led me to a place of understanding that was very different than the world. And as a business person, I wasn't really sure how to bridge that. Do you become a teacher? Do you become a writer, an author? Do I do different businesses? And coming off Everest, I had this vision to make a drink that 100 million people would drink daily that would help them relax. Instead of caffeine or alcohol, something that was more conscious. So we started using two botanicals, kava and kratom, which is beautifully controversial these days, but wonderfully safe and beneficial from the science that we funded and supported and provided to the regulatory agencies. And so I grew this business to $100 million in annual revenue and then sold it. And all through that journey, I really had this feeling that it wasn't the deepest truth. I became more of a business person in consumer products than really realizing what I had understood about why I was here. And my statement all the way through that journey was that the only medicine we needed was our breath and awareness. And I always really wanted to understand how to bring that to people. And so after selling the last business, I spent some time just reading and learning and meditating and sort of thinking about what I wanted to do and endeavoring into what I call quantified consciousness was really what got me excited. And we live in this world where we have mind and awareness and emotions, and then we have technology, and these things are very separate. The algorithms that make decisions about who gets a loan or what your social score is in China, or algorithms are everywhere in our life. It's very different than the nature of human awareness and the human spirit, and so we don't fully understand what consciousness is, let alone whether we can measure it or not. But the idea of starting to measure in some way the journey that I had, the awareness that it changed from someone who was so in conflict with his inner self that he had all these health manifestations that at one point were really close to killing him, to coming to a place that peace and love and joy are accessible in any moment and can become the dominant experience of life, along with an enhanced ability to change and integrate with the world in ways that are very supportive of the revolutions that I think are coming, the changes that I think are coming. This really became motivating to me. And so the question was, what kind of technology can sense the human state and awareness? And there were some great places. So the vision with Evolve Biologics is to utilize technology and particularly sensor fusion, various dynamics of the body, to understand how we experience the world, and then to combine what I think exists as a threat out there, artificial intelligence, to integrate that into that cycle in a way that it becomes an enhanced natural intelligence. We can understand what's under the surface with that iceberg, and that we can understand who we are on a daily basis, and that we can receive help in those moments that matter most, and that we can sort of implement ourselves on a program to change. And I became really inspired of the idea of what if we could measure love? What would it look like if we could measure love in our relationship with ourselves and with people that we meet and with each other? And so that's kind of the endeavor we've been on. And it turns out the heart has a signal. You know all about this.
Are you working with the people at HeartMath by any chance? I interviewed one of those people.
Exactly. Yeah. HeartMath has been such a beautiful inspiration for the world. They've been pioneers in this field, and they've, for me, I've reviewed the extensive literature on heart rate variability. They've very well established that, that the heart has a language and a rhythm and a signature that's beyond the heartbeat, but in the nature of the heart. Mm-hmm. And so that's partly where we started, was to look at, the work that had been published just generally on HRV as well as HeartMath, and to start to bring more advanced technology into it, machine learning, to recognize the unique patterns, to find deeper meanings, in the same way that we mine the stock market to find how do we make more money. We're applying math and empowering individuals to mine their own experience, their own heart, so they can listen, to tune in a little bit deeper and find more love. That's, wow. That might sound a little bit abstract, but... but well, I've been on the platform about a year, and I notice, trialing it for the past year, and I absolutely notice a different me and the people that have been coming along with us. It's a profound experience to tune into something different other than just how much money do I make or what my schedule is or even what my sleep is, but specifically to the emotions that I feel on a daily basis.
Boy, there's so much in it, in everything that you're saying, all these different directions we could go. One interesting thing was that you spoke about artificial intelligence maybe as the enemy on the one hand, and then you referred to deep learning as a tool. You know, and those are kind of closely related technologies, aren't they?
Yeah. So... I would mirror. We start talking about AI. That's quite the rabbit hole. I think in a lot of ways, there's a lot of things in our world to be deeply concerned and afraid about.
Sure.
Long ago, I read Kurzweil's work, The Singularity. Are you familiar with?
Yes.
So my particular take is that that point will emerge where artificial intelligence becomes superhuman, and nano machines become self-assembling, and quantum computing becomes real in a way that when you put those three things together, it's very hard to understand the world. What happens? What does the future look like? And this has been abstract for a long time, but just now we're starting to see what that looks like in our world, where we start tracking people real time. I mean, the social scores in China are deeply concerning, that people who have different spiritual beliefs are being filtered.
I only just learned about that, and maybe I suspect a lot of people don't even know what you're referring to, so go ahead and say what that is.
Yeah, so we live in an ecosystem that so many things are monitored now, what we search, what we buy, how we buy, where we drive, where we move, how we move. All these things sort of get aggregated into a web, and we talk about big data with Google and Apple and et cetera, and where that data goes and what the security and privacy is of it. In a country like China, where that data is centralized, that becomes property of the state in many ways. And so if you're the party doctrine, how do you use that data? And what we're seeing is a filtration of particular ways of being. We're seeing a sorting and a separation and a ranking that has people that don't agree with the philosophy of the day being put into these huge centers that are for retraining. And nobody really knows what happens in there. You get sorted because you believe in, because you're a Muslim instead of a Christian, or because you're a Christian, or you're
You know, a lot of these things have been explored in science fiction, as I'm sure you're aware. And we're seeing some of the dysphoric science fiction stories seeming to manifest.
Yeah, it's happening. It's happening right now. And in the same way that we train drones to kill, and drones make their own kill shot decisions now, which is, you know, depending on where you live in the world, the Terminator movies are real right now. Wow. And that's some pretty dark stuff for people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They want to hear about that. But the thing that gives me hope is human nature and human spirit. And I fundamentally believe through the experiences of my life that there's much more to our existence than just being people that eat and sleep and make money and get angry and harm others. There's something much more to it. There's a greater nature of human consciousness, and in parallel with these the phenomenon of the advancement of technology and the ways in which we see these things being used for evil, or what we might define as evil, I also believe that these technologies can help us uncover our greater human nature. And in this journey with cancer, I was so blessed to be able to touch things that many people still don't think exists. I mean, to say that that someone can heal from an illness, for many people just isn't real, that you can heal naturally, that spontaneous remissions don't occur. But there's lots of cases of that. There's a whole field of medicine called psychoneuroimmunology or psychosomatic medicine. And these things are real, that we understand that our consciousness relates to how we become sick. But there's also really interesting areas of awareness about how our mind actually connects with our physical world. Is it a physical world or an energetic world? And we see this sort of revival of the higher states of consciousness, the altered states of consciousness. And I think this is part of what's driving us into psychedelics. It's that we know that the current form that we exist in as humanity is not going to last very long. And so do we merge with technology? Do we evolve spiritually? I have some theories about that. And I can't think of a more exciting time to be alive, really.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I'm aware that you really have had kind of a shamanic journey, in as much as traditionally the person who is chosen to be a shaman maybe suffered from an illness really had to, was driven inside, I suppose, by the stuff going on in their bodies that they had to deal with. And then somehow the wisdom that they came back with was used by the larger group. And you seem to be a modern version of that. What keeps you from getting a big head? I have to ask that then, because those two can go hand in hand, right?
I would say experience. Every time I get a big head about something, I find I'm knocked down pretty quick, whether it be cancer or business challenges or whatever. And I know that the me that I experience today is just a small fraction of what I will be in the future, and that what we are collectively. Mm. There's so much mystery and there's so much magic in the world.
Yeah.
And we're just beginning to understand it. And I guess coming kind of full circle to Evolve Biologics, I mean, that's really my aspiration, is to help humanity evolve with these existential threats. And I just feel so deeply here. I feel like my role here is to be of service. When I was diagnosed, I made a deal with the higher power. I put my hands up and I said, if I survive, I will dedicate the rest of my life to helping others, you know, be on this journey to make the world a better place.
Good. You know, I was trying to think about, well, what is this space that you're working in, you know, what to call it? And I was trying to come up with a name for the category that Evolve Biologics is in. And I came up with apps that potentially will help promote deep personal transformation.
I like that.
Also, another one that came to mind was Spirit Tech. That sounds like a company name.
Nice.
Do you have a way of thinking about the category that you are in? And do you have, I don't want to say competitors, you know, you think, who else, instead of thinking of them as competitors, do you have collaborators in other companies that are straining towards the same sorts of vision.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a few points there. I really appreciate the way you're thinking about that. I do think about that in a similar way. I think a lot of the world is approaching things symptomatically. You know, anxiety and depression are sort of things that we experience pain on a daily basis. But there are much larger threats that are approaching, some of which we spoke about. I mean, right now, jobs are being automated at a scale that has never existed before. And the last time we had a technological revolution, we think back to the early 1900s, World War ensued afterwards. That was when the Luddites were at fight with technology and jobs were replaced and the socioeconomic status decreased and war was the result. And so now we have similar kind of existential crises, but to a scale that we've never experienced. What does it look like when 40% of jobs are phased out? And there's debates about that, whether it's 3 years or 10 years, but the number keeps getting shorter. And so how do these people reinvent themselves? How do we reinvent ourselves? It's about every occupation that we can imagine. Someone is working on doing that through artificial intelligence. And so what does humanity become after that? And I think this is the larger category. It's reinventing who we are as a species. Mm-hmm. And I think that change will come a lot faster than most people think. And if we're not actively working together to plan it, then I think it could be quite chaotic and painful for a lot of people. So my viewpoint is that illness is a great way. Emotion is a great way, and illness is a great way to enter. So if we're dealing with persistent illnesses, it would be, how do I discover my consciousness in a way that allows me to change the course of that disease to impact my life in a different way? Whether it's an emotional disease, let's say like anxiety or depression, the way they've been categorized by the DSM, let's say, or whether it's just a lack of hope and meaning and purpose in our life. I think technology and what I'm seeking to do with our platform is to bring people to the feeling of the emotions of love and peace and joy, and then to look at how we can integrate those into our lives and change our experience of life. But that's just the beginning. The deeper part is to understand what the greater reaches of human nature are. And I think when we speak about competition, as a business person, I mean, the first couple hundred books I read were business books. We're always thinking about how we build competitive, sustainable competitive advantage and how we use intellectual property to block things. And I think this is a different kind of revolution. I said spiritual business, and spiritual can sometimes have a lot of negative attachment to it, right. But in a way that we're serving all of humanity. So I don't know that we can actually have competition in that respect. But if I were to think about the other businesses that are positioning, for me, it's a much deeper cause. It's about the future of humanity and how we define that experientially, practically, action-oriented, how we view these threats and find new solutions to them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a wonderful statement. And, you know, maybe that's the one we should close with, because typically I ask my guest, you know, how would you like to wrap things up? And I think you've just done a good job of it, although I hate to kind of break the contact here. I'm really enjoying speaking with you. So you've got lots to do, Steve.
Yeah. If you did let me summarize, what I would love to say is that I really believe that it's important that we look at our future eyes open, that we see the possibilities of what's coming, and that we take action on it. I really believe that we can take action. And if anybody wants to join me in this revolution, coming over to Evolve Biologics, signing up for our newsletter, for the first, let's say, you know, 50 people that come from your program, be happy to give them some of our new technology free. They can join and help us collaborate to create it.
Oh, that's a great offer. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have beautiful followers and amazing people that you've had on on your program. So I don't have all the answers, and it's something that I'd love to create on. But we are working on some pretty magical stuff. And as you mentioned, we're a little bit stealth on it, but letting some people in would be a wonderful experience.
Okay. Well, Steve Curtis, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. It's been transformative.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Wow. I felt so excited at the end of this interview. I was energized by Steve's verve, his incredible story, the rapport between us, his vision for the future, and also by the way this interview came to pass. In a way, this interview feels fated to me. As longtime listeners will know, one of the many hats I've worn over the years is that of a marketing research consultant. It was my love of technology that actually drew me in that rather unexpected direction several decades ago. Now, this was after I was already a psychotherapist, psychologist, and university professor. When I first went off to college, I thought it was to become an electrical engineer. I had been accepted with a full scholarship in engineering at the University of Pennsylvania. I quickly discovered my high school preparation in math and science wasn't up to the demands of an Ivy League university. So I switched out of engineering into a major in creative writing. But later, as graduation became imminent, I realized I'd need a profession to support myself and started to work on becoming a psychotherapist. Jump ahead quite a few years, and I'm already a therapist and psychology professor, but the computer and internet revolutions are starting to take off, and I can sense how exciting and important they're going to be. And I'm kicking myself for not having become an electrical engineer. I'm wondering if there might be a way for me to take part in the upcoming revolution without having to go back to school to be an engineer. Lo and behold, a door opens up, and I learn about a market research tool called Focus Group Research. I apprenticed myself to a fellow who taught me the business, and I went out on my own a number of years later when he retired. The market research business was my window into the world of high tech, as I conducted research for Apple, Hewlett-Packard, Atari, Electronic Arts, Texas Instruments, and many others. And I did all this while still managing to hang on to my psychology professor job. If you're interested, you can see my market research consulting website at www.e-focusgroups.com. Well, 2 or 3 months ago, Steve's marketing director at Evolve Biologics contacted me about possibly helping them with some market research focus groups. This was without him knowing any of my history with podcasting, consciousness studies, psychedelics, meditation, etc. However, as he described the product that they're working on, I spoke up and said, I might be a perfect match for you guys, and told him about Shrink Wrap Radio and so on. And he said, you know, you might want to consider interviewing our CEO on your podcast. Voila, so that's how we got here for today's interview. You can see why it's such a fortuitous and magical connection. Who knows where it might lead, but I'm totally stoked by Steve's story and feel we have a lot in common in terms of our interests, values, excitement about both the promise and the threat of where technology seems to be taking us, the potential of psychedelic medicines, and so on. I can't wait for his book to come out. It will fill in some of the gaps in his story that I didn't get to follow up on. For example, did he really say he climbed Everest with 3 other people and he was the only one to come back? What happened to the other 3? Did he have Sherpas who helped him survive the journey? And so many other details I'd like to follow up on. And of course, there's so much more detail we'll be looking for in relation to how he was able to achieve his, quotes, spontaneous remission from a supposedly incurable cancer. One of the consciousness technologies you heard us discuss is HeartMath. I immediately recognized that Steve's planned app/device has been influenced by that approach, and he readily confirmed that fact. Consequently, you might want to follow up on this interview with my Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 324, Exploring Heart Math with Roland McCready, PhD. And I'm happy to report that there's also a transcript for that interview on our website. Dr. McCrady has worked with the Institute of Heart Math since its inception in 1991. Now, in fact, this leads into the very generous offer Steve made toward the end of the interview. Shrink Wrap Radio listeners will be able to get the Evolve Biologics device, which includes a heart rate monitor, as beta testers for free, except for the rather nominal cost of shipping. This device would ordinarily cost $99 plus shipping. Among its features, the device measures heart rate variability. I definitely suggest you explore their website first to get an idea of all of the functionality of this device. They are eager to collect feedback from actual users of the device to the extent that they'll ship you two of the devices for free, except for the nominal shipping cost. You can give the second device to a family member or friend. Although they're working on a version for Android, at present, you'll need an Apple iPhone or iPad. Now, to take advantage of this offer, go to their website at www.evolvebiologics.com. Let me spell that out for you. It's EVOLVEBIOLOGIX.com. So go there. Click on the Shop Now tab at the top of the page, and then click on the red box that says Pre-Order Now for $99. On the order form, you'll see a box for entering the discount code, which is Dr. Dave, all caps, and it's spelled D-R-D-A-V-E, one word, all caps. This offer is for the first 50 of you who respond. So get your order in right away, but be aware that it may take 30 days or so before the devices actually ship. But this is your chance to get in on the ground floor and help shape this exciting technology.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Morgan Adolfsen from Norway, clinical psychologist. I've been a long-time listener to both Wise Counsel and Shrink Wrap Radio. Today, I'm so happy that I pressed the donate button. So from this day, I will regularly contribute to support your shows. And I really appreciate your work, Dave. So good luck. Thank you.
Well, thank you, psychotherapist Morgan Adolfsen there in Norway. I'm so touched by the testimony and encouragement you've just offered, and I hope others will be as moved as I am. And with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. I want to say thanks again to Steve Curtis, founder and CEO of EvolveBiologics.com, for sharing some of the exciting details of his life and the beta tester opportunity for Shrink Wrap Radio listeners. My guests for next week will be Chi Amsterdam and Letty Passamaye, speaking about their Psychedelic Truffle Retreat Center in Amsterdam, as well as some of their other initiatives. You may recall my interview with Paul Austin and his Synthesis Center in Amsterdam for psilocybin retreats. I'm very interested to get another perspective on the legal psychedelic retreats in the Netherlands. So, until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.